Good afternoon, everyone. As Walter said, I am James Fallows from the Atlantic Monthly. Like everyone else here, I share the great honor of having President Bill Clinton come join us. Unlike any of the rest of you, I have a particular challenge. The interviewer of Bill Clinton faces a basic choice. One can say, you know, what do you know that's interesting? Or what's new and what do you care? We can all sit back for the next hour. Or we could go that way. If one were dutiful enough or enough of a dreamer, one could try to impose a theme on the discussion. And I am dutiful enough and will try to be enough of a dreamer to try this latter. And the way I'm going to try to get the president to go along with me is by suggesting why he is uniquely in the world positioned to discuss the themes we have in mind. And this is actually true. And so I'm going to lay out the three themes I hope we'll be able to get to. They're ones that President Clinton has gone into in a way that nobody else on earth actually has. And they are the following: global concerns and issues and challenges, which he's been addressing largely under the auspices of his Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative. What is unique about his position here is not simply is he the second youngest man ever to leave the presidency, he is the youngest person ever to not be president and know he could not run again. Teddy Roosevelt, who was 50 when he left the presidency, could and did run again. Bill Clinton, who is 54, has, we hope, many, many years ahead of him to have a huge impact on the world, which he's already begun to have through his foundation. Second, we'd like to talk about some domestic political concerns and issues and challenges where his standing to speak is obvious in many ways. But a particular aspect of his standing to speak is to being the first Democrat since FDR to win and serve two full terms, and save for those pesky constitutional amendments based on the polls, he would have been the first to win and serve three terms. So we'll ask about his political expertise. And then finally, I'd like to get some of his views of particular issues between the United States and the rest of the world, which have been an ongoing leitmotif at this conference. Here his standing is not simply is the American who is best liked in the rest of the world, according to recent polls, but according to polls I saw this morning, he is the most popular man on earth. Is that enough? Yes, it's true. Now,
slim pickings.
Okay, there's slim pickings out there.
So you must not have given them the right choices.
So, you know, it may be like the people's sexiest man alive. This may be transitory, but at least for this moment, you see the most popular person on the world is here with us. So that's the goal. And then we'll have time for some questions, depending on how much of his expertise the president shares with us. So that's the ambition. So...
That's the nicest way of telling me to not talk too much, ever.
I've been in this situation before. So let's start with the global perspective. Since leaving office, you've poured a lot of... I remember I interviewed you 4 years ago in circumstances like this, when you said your priorities were to build your foundation, to write your book, and to begin, you know, working on some of these long-term global initiatives. You've been doing a lot of work in AIDS and other health issues, and religious and ethnic conciliation, increasingly in climate change issues. I wonder if you tell us which of these issues look different to you now from when you were president, in the sense of their urgency, their solvability, their new nature, and if also, second, you talk in particular about the climate change issue, which I know has been more and more on your mind.
Well, first let me say, I will try to be brief about both of these, but I want to say both the AIDS and climate change issues look somewhat different to me. When I was in my second term, in my first term, America still had, we thought, the biggest AIDS problem. And we spent all of our time trying to turn it around and were largely successful in doing so. In my second term, we were able to like triple America's overseas AIDS budget. And we devoted a lot of time to helping countries start their programs. But I don't think I remotely understood the scope of the challenge or the necessary systematic challenges to meet it. When I left office, I have to give President Bush credit for this. He got a lot more money out of the Republican Congress for AIDS than I could have, and I think he deserves credit for it. And they did set up their own program, PEPFAR. I would have preferred to see more of the money going to the Global Fund on AIDS, TB, and malaria, but we work with the Bush program in many of the countries in which I work. What I know now about this is what I know about a lot of other things in developing countries and in poorer communities in America, which is that it's not just a money problem. Intelligence and ability and effort are largely evenly distributed throughout the world, but organizations and systematic capacity aren't. So, and if you don't have the requisite level of organization and systematic capacity, very often the money will come a cropper. It won't be as effective, no matter whether it's delivered in a unilateral fashion like PEPFAR and a multilateral fashion like the Global Fund. So what I tried to do there was to organize first the generic drug markets and the testing markets to get the prices down to the lowest levels in the world, and then to organize the countries involved so that if something happened to me or our foundation, they would still have a system that would work for them, not only in dealing with AIDS, but in other health problems as well. And I get that in a way I didn't when I was president. With regard to climate change, you know, I was just going back. The best thing about the 2005 energy bill that the Congress passed and President Bush signed, in my opinion, and I didn't like a lot of it, but they did give a 25% tax credit for the purchase of clean energy technologies. So I went back and read the speech I gave in 1997 advocating that. And it was given at the National Geographic Building, and Al Gore went there. We hyped the living daylights out of it to the press. And, you know, I advocated this and talked about what's going on. Is it on now? I talked about the problems of global warming, and we were running up to Kyoto then. And I thought it was a pretty good speech. And it was a total dud. I mean, nobody covered it even. It elicited a giant yawn from the press and the American public. And it was significant in only one respect. I told Newt Gingrich once that I thought the signal political achievement of my second term was that I finally found a tax cut he would oppose. Because, you know, big oil and big coal were against cutting taxes to buy solar power and wind power and, you know, all that other stuff. It was interesting. So, but the reason was oil was low and the core of people who understood this was smaller. So what I've learned about that since I got out is two things. One is it's a lot worse than I thought it was when I was in. And I believe, you know, all the evidence shows that. There's a new story in the paper today where a lot of Western timber and fire experts are saying that the increased wildfires in the West are primarily due to rapidly warming temperatures here in the summertime. A lot worse than I thought. Second thing I've learned is I've only confirmed my conviction that looking at this as a threat, and I don't know if you remember this, but after we negotiated the Kyoto Treaty, I think it's the only thing the Senate ever voted unanimously on the whole time I was president. They voted like 85 or 90 to nothing to reject it before I even presented it to them, because they believed it would wreck the American economy. And compare our economy to Britain's, where they're going to meet their Kyoto targets. We have similar economic systems, similar unemployment rates, but wages are stagnant in America and poverty is rising and inequality is rising. They have rising wages and declining inequality, and I believe the most important reason is, I'd like to tell you it's because Tony Blair has economic policies more like mine, but the truth is, I think the most important reason is they took climate change seriously, and because they did, they've created hundreds of thousands of new jobs in new areas by going for a clean energy future. And I feel more strongly about that than I ever did. The third thing I've learned that we don't have time to talk about unless somebody asks about it is that, about the climate change. This is very important. I was reading a book the other day by a guy just bashing the living hell out of me about saying that he was certain the CIA briefed me once a week on how America was running out of oil and I did nothing serious about it. Of course, he ignored what we tried to do and got our brains beat out doing. But that's not true. To the best of my knowledge, I never had a security briefing which said what some of these very serious but conservative petroleum geologists say, which is they think that either now or before the decade's out, we'll reach peak oil production globally, and with the rise of China and India and others coming along, unless we can dramatically reduce our oil usage, we will run out of recoverable oil within 35 to 50 years. And that would mean that in addition to climate change, we have a very short time in the life of the planet to turn this around. So I think that we all need to start thinking about, as we propose practical solutions to climate change, what we all need to keep this in the back of our mind. There's a good chance these people who've made a living all these years studying petroleum deposits know what they're talking about, and we may not have as much oil as we think. So we need to get in gear. But it's a blessing. It's a bird's nest on the ground. America needs a source of new jobs, and we should be leading the way. Furthermore, if we don't, the Chinese and the Indians will never follow suit, and we're cooked anyway.
Let me follow up with just one further aspect on this climate change issue. As you're well aware, this is one of many cases in the U.S. where the facts are determined by political orientation, more or less. There are a set of that the very success of your former Vice President Al Gore's movie has made people both persuaded by his argument and identifying with him and with your administration, with the Democratic Party. How do you think this issue either will or should be resolved in terms of having a common set of facts and action plan agreed on?
Well, I think, first of all, in order to get broad bipartisan support and have it bite with the American people, you have to put the climate change issue into the context of, first, you have to inject this oil depletion issue. This needs some much more serious debate. It's almost not discussed at all in the mainstream media, and very few people know about it. You've got to read these books by these geologists or people who talk to them to, you know, form and get a grip on the facts. Secondly, we need to present it in terms of a national security and an economic development argument, as well as climate change. Obviously, if we become more independent of foreign oil, not simply from the Middle East, but from Venezuela and elsewhere, we have a freer hand in pursuing our values and our other interests in foreign policy. And most important, if you want America to have an open economy, to continue to be a free trading nation, to try to help other countries to lift their own fortunes, and you want to maintain support within America for that, you can't have another 5 years like the last five. We had 5 years where we had increasing productivity from American workers and no wage increases, no average wage increases. That's never happened since economists have been taking statistics. And I believe it's because the job growth is so low. We had average wages weren't increasing in my first term, even when we were creating a lot of jobs, and hadn't since 1973. But they did increase in the second term for the first time since 73. And inequality went down because we had so many new jobs that were well-paying. And again, I think it was our good fortune because the 90s were the decade in which information technology moved out of being the province of Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C. and Route 28 in Massachusetts and the video game makers in Texas and basically permeated every aspect of the American economy, and it drove a whole range of good new jobs. This decade's new jobs are in clean energy, and we haven't seized them. And that's why we're in the economic kind of doldrums, even though we have good growth numbers, good productivity numbers, and low unemployment. So that's how you make it bite. You got to present it in a way that's not just climate change. Although if you present it like Al did in that movie, it makes it more compelling. But I don't think that movie, and I thought he was terrific, and I loved it, but I don't think it would have been nearly as compelling if we didn't have $70 oil. Do you? If we had $25 oil, you think that we'd be doing as well with it as we are? No. So, but we need to get on this and stay with it.
So I know there are many, many other issues you've been working on the global front. I'd like to shift now, due to the tyranny of time, to a second area of your role as political historian, political practitioner, political wizard to assess some parts of the current situation. And there are two particular aspects of current American politics I would like to hear your views on. One, you know in a particular way the experience of a president who thinks a congressional election might be going against his party. You know, it's very different when this happens 2 years into administration from 6 years into administration, but you know what the signs are, you know the dynamics. Wonder if you would assess how this congressional looks to you, election looks to you historically, the sort of telltales you see indicating one way or the other. The other political thing, and also the fact the Democrats, the Republicans in 1994 had a contract with America they were running on. The Democrats so far haven't come up with a quite as crisp a document. The related question is, Karl Rove is going to be speaking here tomorrow, and he's shown that a political strategy doesn't have to be secret to work. Everybody knows what his strategy is, and he's run very well on it. Since you are released from the bonds of secrecy, what is the strategy you would recommend to your party, the story they should tell now to take back the Congress?
Well, first, let's go to your first question. You ask about what do I think is going to happen historically. The truth is I don't No, anybody tells you they know is either a lot smarter than I am or just blowing smoke. But historically, we should win seats in both the House and the Senate, and we might well win one or both houses because there are objective problems in the country, and because, you know, I just think, I don't know how long they can make this old dog hunt, and where they, you know, ever since 2000, the 2002 and 2004 elections were about, no matter how bad you think we are, you can't vote for them because you can't trust them to defend the country. And oh, by the way, forget about global warming. Let's talk about flag burning and gay marriage. I mean, I just don't know how long you can milk that old cow without the milk running dry. And I, you know, it's a pretty hard deal. But we should win. Now, whether we can win or not, it depends on a lot of things. We had a lot more congressional districts in play in 94 than we do now because of reapportionment and because, frankly, our Democrats had an artificially high position in the House of Representatives. A lot of those districts have been voting Republican in national election, presidential elections for a long time. So the reapportionment makes it tougher. I think my advice is that we should have a national campaign which basically reiterates what we believe the differences are between not just Republicans and Democrats, but the relatively discreet section of the Republican Party that has totally controlled the national government for the last 6 years. They run the Congress and they run the White House. They don't even represent all the Republicans. And we should say what the differences are, and then we should say what we're for. And I agree that our leaders have not done that so far, but keep in mind, they didn't do that contract for the America deal till September. And I believe Chuck Schumer and Rahm Emanuel are doing a real good job as head of these campaign committees. Now, they're not only raising money, they've recruited great candidates. We've got 9 Iraq War veterans running for the House. It's Democrats. And I think that if they say, look, we're going to take this country in a different direction, they don't have to have big things. We're going to go for a clean energy future. We're going to reinstitute fiscal conservatism with those tough budget rules. We're going to rewrite the drug bill so that you can bargain for lower prices, and that way we'll get rid of this donut, which is about to hit hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of American seniors. And Einstein can't figure it out. And we're going to raise the minimum wage, restore cuts in the college loan program. And we're going to have a serious security program at home. I think we can, you know, Karl Rove said that he was going to say we lived in a pre-9/11 world and the Republicans lived in a post-9/11 world. You tell me. Example one. The White House and the House Republicans oppose spending $648 million a year to put in very high technology, sophisticated scanning equipment that would at least give us a screen on all the cargo containers coming into all the ports and airports in America. They said, we can't do that. It's too expensive. We got too big a budget. They just took $4 billion out of the military budget, part of which was going to buy body armor. What was their first priority this year? Repealing the estate tax. What does it cost? About $250 billion over 10 years for less than 1% of the American people, including me. I love saying this. I never had any money before I left the White House. So he's willing to spend more than 20 times what it would cost to put in this safe port material. The Republican Party in the Congress are willing to spend more than 20 times what it would cost to make 300 million Americans safer to help less than 1% of us. That tells you all you need to know about the differences. And if we can't make that dog hunt, we don't know how to sell anything. You know, I just think you got to paint a picture here. Nobody connects all the dots. There's lots of other dots we could connect. But I mean, I don't think we ought to play a treason card on them. I don't think we ought to do all that stuff Rove did, you know, comparing Max Cleland to Saddam Hussein and all that. I don't think we ought to do that. But I believe the American people are starved for a serious discussion of the real differences, and they don't mind if we have a tough argument, but they don't want it to be personally demonizing. They want us to talk about these specific differences and what the consequences are. And I'd start with that one.
As you know, the area where Democrats have for the last, say, two decades been bedeviled in telling a story involves the whole realm of national security, international security. Of the three elements of President Bush's axis of evil, Iraq and Iran and North Korea, on any two of them, what would be the line the Democrats should tell? Or even three?
Well, let's go through them. On Iraq, first of all, I think that we ought to be whipped, we Democrats, if we allow our differences over what to do now in Iraq to divide us instead of focusing on replacing Republicans in the Congress. That's the nuttiest strategy I ever heard in my life. I mean, look, there are a few Democrats, and Senator Lieberman, my friend, is one, who genuinely believed what the president believed and Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld believed and apparently what Senator McCain believes and a number of other people, which was we should just get rid of Saddam, whether he's got any weapons or not, and it doesn't matter if we let the UN inspectors finish. That was also the position of every Israeli politician I knew, by the way. There are a lot of people who believe it. Most Democrats didn't. But the question is, once you break the eggs, do you have some responsibility to make an omelet? Or as General Powell used to say, if you take it, you own it. What? If you break it, you own it. So we got to make an omelet. So the issue is, what should we do? I think the Democrats should say, I like what the Levin, Biden, Reid crowd that Hillary was involved in. I like that resolution. They said, we don't think it's right to have a fixed timetable for withdrawal. Why send a signal to the people that are trying to keep Iraq divided and tear it up when we're going to go? Would you make any political deals if you knew that you could just hang around and maybe get what you want? So, but on the other hand, I think staying forever in what is now a political as well as a military situation is an error. So I think we ought to say what the Levin thing is, but I don't think we ought to demonize the people that say we should set a fixed date for withdrawal. And in the case of a guy like Lieberman, you know, you think of all the other issues. He got endorsed in Connecticut by labor, by the environmental groups, by the gay groups, by all these other groups. We got a world of differences between ourselves and the Republicans. So I think the Democrats are making a mistake to go after each other instead of for a situation none of them created. It's bewildering to me. We ought to be talking about our differences. But what I favor on Iraq, basically, I think it'd be nice if we could draw down. It'd be nice if we had some more special forces to send there. It'd be nice if we could, you know, we can make this work. But the main thing is they got a new government. We got to give them a chance to resolve the political situation. And I think my own view is it'd be an error to say we're going to leave by X date. It may come a time when it's obvious it can't be made to work, and if so, we ought to do something else. I would personally like to see a drawdown for a different reason than some people would. I'm worried about Afghanistan. I'm worried about the Taliban making a comeback. I'm worried about the Al-Qaeda still having a little more juice than everybody thinks they do. I think we made an error not to stabilize our situation there more. So I'd like to see more of our assets freed up for whatever they're need for. On North Korea, you know, they're a perplexing country. They can't grow rice, but they can make missiles and bombs and things. And my view is that they, and I can't say, General Powell said the same thing last night at dinner. You know, when they do these things like this, they want somebody to notice them. And they don't ever get noticed except when they misbehave. It's like, you know, if you got a bunch of kids and one of them feels in your house that he or she's not noticed enough, and they never get noticed until they break the cookie jar. And I don't want to minimize this. I think North Korea, it's a bad thing that they've got this level of technology in a repressive country with all their problems. But I think what they want is not to disappear, to be able to eat and stay warm, to be recognized as important in North Asia, and I think we have to try to work these things through with them. I don't think we should reward their misconduct, but we need to try to make a deal. We had some success in doing that in the 8 years I was there, but I think, you know, that this is one area where the Bush administration has insisted on these six-party talks, and I respect that. But at least when I was there, I can't comment on it now, It was the one area of the world where everybody else wanted us to handle it bilaterally because they knew that's about the only thing the North Koreans would respond to. So I just think we ought to not overreact to this. I thought when the president sent the naval forces into the North Pacific, I thought that was a good thing to do. Didn't make much of it. You know, we didn't hyperventilate rhetorically. We just wanted to remind that fella not to drop those missiles too close to Japan. You know, it's a good thing to do. But I don't think we need to freak out there. Iran's harder. You know, they could... It's a problem because if they develop the nuclear capacity and they don't have total control over the materials, then some renegades within their own country could get it to terrorist groups and you could have small, dirty bombs. I think the thing that you should be worried most about Iranian nuclear capacity, in my opinion, besides whatever psychological effect it has on the balance of power in the Middle East, is whether or not by accident or design some of the fissile material would be given to terrorist groups who could make smaller nuclear explosives that could kill lots and lots of people. Because I think all the money we spent going back to the end of the Cold War, and this started in the first Bush administration, so I can't claim any credit for the non-Luger program except to have supported it with all my heart and to believe that we should do more to try to contain these biological, chemical, and nuclear sources. I think there is no option but to negotiate. I was encouraged that Secretary Rice said that she was willing to negotiate, and we're going to talk. I think this idea that there's some people we shouldn't talk to because they're so bad is nuts. I mean, if we have enough self-confidence in who we are, we shouldn't be scared to talk to anybody. And if you got a bunch of weapons, you can always kill somebody tomorrow, but you can't bring them back tomorrow. So you might as well just talk it through as long as you can, try to figure out what your options are. I don't think it's easy, but I think that the one thing I would say is I don't think Americans should put too many preconditions on the talks with the Iranians. I was willing, when Mr. Khatami was president of Iran, I was willing to have direct contacts with him, but he felt that his position, because he was a reformer, was sufficiently precarious is too strong a word, but uncertain, that they didn't want to engage in negotiations with us at that time, because of the tensions within Iran. Now, President Ahmadinejad doesn't have that problem. And so I think Secretary Rice was right to say we would talk, but I don't think we should have too many preconditions. We shouldn't try to cook it too much in advance. We need to see if we just can't get around this. It'll be a bad deal, if they have nuclear power that's capable of being made into bombs. But I also think it would be a matter of some serious consequence to think that we should attack them militarily and that we can do it without other very adverse secondary and tertiary consequences. So I think she's on the right track, but I don't think we ought to put too many conditions. I just think they ought to talk, see if they can't figure out some way to go forward.
Let me use that, if I could, as a segue to a third area of discussion, which also involves U.S. relations with the rest of the world. This is a largely American gathering here, although with a significant international presence. And one theme of many, many discussions has been the current situation of the U.S. moral standing, the U.S. soft power, the U.S. reputation to the rest of the world. Some non-Americans saying, oh, you Americans are beating up too much on yourselves. Others saying, no, 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 until you regain the moral high ground, you're going to be in terrible trouble, struggling against terrorism, trying to do anything else you want. Drawing on your standing as the most popular man on earth, I wonder if you would. What should the
United States? You say that one more time, I'll get sick. Half of them are already sick, so go ahead.
What story should the United States be telling now? How exactly can it do better in this war of ideas, war of reputation, war of moral standing?
Well, first of all, I think we have to realize there will be times when, as long as we're in the position we're in, or even when others may acquire some greater parity with us on a military and economic or political plane, there'll always be times when we will be making decisions that some people won't agree with. So I think, they need to think that in general, we wish them well, and that we are trying to take the world to a place where everybody on earth has a chance to live their dreams and to pursue their faith and to preserve their culture and to make a decent living. So to me, that's the first thing. People just get a sense of that. I remember once I was in Sri Lanka talking to one of the parliamentary leaders of the Tamil Tigers, and we had him on the terrorist list the whole time I was president. And he said, you know, you had us on the terrorist list the whole time you're president, but I liked you anyway. And I said, you did? He said, yeah. I said, why? He said, because I always figured that you wanted my people to have a fair break here, that you thought the Hindus should be treated fairly. Now, that I don't mean to be self-serving. That's the first thing that came to my mind. But the point is, people get a sense of, you want people to admire, not resent America. And when they disagree with us, you want them to disagree with us in the way you have a disagreement within your family or your business or any other worker. You want them to think basically we're the good guys on the right side of history and we're pulling for them. Now, therefore, I think this is a lot more about a lot more than Iraq. This is also about the fact that we said we're not interested in Kyoto or the International Criminal Court or the ABM Treaty or the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It was about rhetoric, you know. But let me just do the flip side here. I promise you that America is more popular among people who've been personally touched by the president's AIDS program. There are two Muslim countries where our standing is better than it was a couple years ago. And they're both important. One, the largest, Indonesia, and the other, the most troublesome, Pakistan, because it's home to so many Taliban and Al-Qaeda sympathizers. And the reasons are the tsunami and the earthquake. I mean, you know, I saw this myself. When former President Bush and I took our first trip over to the tsunami area, and we were up there in Aceh in Indonesia, and, you know, we visited these little kids, and part of their therapy, if they lost their families during the tsunami, was to draw pictures of what they saw. Picture after picture after picture. American military helicopters dropping food, not bombs, dropping ladders to get people out of isolated places. You'd meet the USAID workers there, or all these people from religious or non-religious NGOs. Or George Bush and I even met two different groups of people who were just represented their own small businesses back in America who were in the water purification business. And they just quit what they were doing and came there because they read that kids might die of cholera or dysentery or diarrhea. And they didn't want to happen. They just showed up and said, send me someplace and I'll clean the water. And not surprisingly, all the people saw us as people because they thought we saw them as people. And religion and politics and geography and none of that stuff mattered very much. Now, I don't want to be naive about this. When we got our backs against the wall, we're all differently turned. But we need to remember that lesson. And we need to try to show that face to the world. They need to think we're pulling for them. We need to say the same thing in economics. Look, the one reason Hugo Chavez has got a lot of juice in Latin America, besides having a lot of money to throw around, is there, you know, Latin Americans have not benefited very much from globalization, the average walking around person. And, you know, we take the position in globalization that all natural resources everywhere should be subject to free trade and investment, i.e., if you got the oil, we should be able to buy it or invest in your oil wells. But we take a very different view when it comes to intellectual property. And it's fine if you're an American, but if you're Brazil and you're trying to find ways to keep all your kids alive who are HIV positive, or an African country with a far higher investment, you know, you've got to forgive them if they have a different view of this. So at least we have to give people the sense that we know what it's like to walk in their shoes. And we need to realize you can't have a global economy without a global social policy. And in an interdependent world, you can't kill, jail, or occupy all your enemies, so you got to have more friends and fewer enemies, even while you got a tough security policy. And that's what I think is the most important thing. And I did things that people didn't agree with. You got to, if you're American at this moment in history, you can't possibly please everybody all the time. But they get a sense about whether you're pulling for them or not, and whether you want them to share your future.
I want to embarrass him, but he's not in office anymore, so I can't hurt him. But that's what General Powell did when he was Secretary of State, when he went around the world. People said, that guy is on my side. It didn't matter what he was talking about or whether they agreed with him. As long as we're the biggest dog on the block, we need people out there doing that. They need to feel that about America.
I'm going to invite questions in just a moment. I have one other question to ask the President before calling you to the microphones. You are a former constitutional law professor, a former president. In light of the recent Supreme Court ruling on presidential power, how do you think we should understand the expansions and limits of executive power in the last 5 years?
Well, first of all, there have always been differences over this. You know, if you go back and read ex-parte McCardle and ex-parte Yeager in the Civil War and whether Abraham Lincoln could suspend the writ of habeas corpus. I mean, we're always going to have these tensions. And in times of national emergency, when security issues are at stake, the executive will naturally try to claim more ground. And there have to be forces on the other side trying to hold the ground and having an honest debate so that we don't respond to any crisis by fundamentally changing the character of our country and thereby compromising the future of our children. For example, I don't mind the fact that the president wants to find out more about financial transactions that might lead to uncover money laundering by terrorists or narco-traffickers or anybody else. I tried to pass legislation on that when I was in my second term, and the Congress wouldn't pass it and didn't pass anything until after 9/11. I think it's really important. But I think it's outrageous the way the New York Times has been beat up here because they practically publicized all the details of it themselves beforehand. I think this is just, again, it's election season, and that might work better than the Flag Amendment and the Gay Marriage Amendment. I think that's what's going on here. On the other hand, every president and every executive branch, they do have the right and the responsibility to engage in some secret activities to advance your security. But there's got to be limits to it. And that's why I think the Supreme Court case, you know, this Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, all this stuff, this type, if you don't follow the Geneva rules, if you really look like you're legitimizing torture, I think it makes our own soldiers, it puts them more at risk. I think it undermines what I talked about before about whether people think we could possibly be pulling for them. And I think it gives more juice to our enemies. And therefore, you have to have limits on power, even recognizing that once in a while there might be grievous consequences of that, too. Let's not be Pollyanna here. Any president under these circumstances would press for some more executive authority. No president, given the present security threats to the country, could responsibly not have certain security activities that are secret. The question is, in a constitutional democracy, where are the limits and who sets them and who pushes at it? And if the Congress is not inclined to do that, and this Congress has not been inclined, then the only repositories are the courts and the press. And I don't think there are any other alternatives. And the other party, I mean, we can raise all the sand we want, but if we don't have the votes, they can blow by us. So that's what I think. I think it actually will strengthen our hand that the Supreme Court made that decision. Because we, as long as we make clear that we're not saying that we don't want to catch terrorists, we're not saying we want to suspend all secret activities, we're not saying anything, we're just saying, you know, we're a government of laws, and everybody has some limits. Nobody is totally above the law. And I see this as a salutary development, just like I thought it was a salutary development when Senator McCain got that bill through the Congress to require the American people to say we not for torture. He shouldn't have had to do it, but he did have to, and I was glad he did it.
There are microphones around the room, I believe. I cannot see them myself at this moment, but while preparing for them, there's a person with a microphone. The first question from the audience comes in virtual form. Somebody, for reasons will become evident, I've been asked to ask this question of you. Izzy Elon, who's a 10-year-old boy in San Francisco, has a question that he wanted very much to hear your views on. He'd been suffering from leukemia for 5 years. He's almost finished with his chemotherapy. And his question is, coming out of such a struggle, he would like to hear from President Clinton, what do I have to look forward to?
Well, first of all, I think even though you're only 10, if you've been through this, you've learned how to take tough medicine. So what you have to look forward to first will depend in part on whether your chemotherapy is working. But more and more people are surviving. And I think the honest answer is what you have to look forward to is what you decide to look forward to. And I would say to you at 10, you should rekindle your dreams and think you're going to live to be 80 and live accordingly. And if you find that your cancer returns and you have to have treatment again, then you should try to beat it. But you should live every day with your dreams in front of you, and it will increase the chances that you'll succeed.
So I believe there's a microphone over here. I would ask all the questioners two things. First, to identify yourself and be as concise as you possibly can be so we can have as many questions as the time allows. Is there a question over here?
Hi, Joel Tauber. Mr. President, you in your remarks, you mentioned that it's right to talk to some of your enemies so that you can get on, at least on some kind of common grounds. And I was wondering about your feelings about Hamas and whether we ought to be talking with them.
Yeah, I have a split position there. I don't know. There may be more to what's gone on in the press, I mean, in Gaza and in the whole area in the last few weeks to change this. I actually thought the president and the European Union were right to say, we're not going to give any aid directly to this government, just even if they won an honest election, when they won't disavow terror or recognize Israel's right to exist or say they're going to honor these previously negotiated trade treaties. Everything from the signing on the White House lawn in 93 through the Wye River Accord. I thought that was right. On the other hand, I thought they were right to try to get them some humanitarian aid. But consistent with my position is I'd still talk to them if they wanted to talk. And there's all kinds of ways to do it. You know, you don't have to advertise it. You don't have to put it in the paper. You don't have to send the highest ranking person in the world there. But I'd always be talking. And I would be surprised even today if the Israelis aren't in touch with the Hamas government. So I just think, look, this whole deal is, as you might imagine, and as you know, personally, is very painful to me because I spent a lot of time on it. Some people think I spent too much time on it. But I know one thing. We're just playing out this sad old drama. It's just a question of how many people are going to die before they make the only deal they can make that will stop people from dying. And it's a classic example of interdependence, which can be good, bad, or both. So for 7 years and a couple of months, we had progress toward positive interdependence. Then Mr. Arafat rejected my last peace offer, and the Second Intifada started, and we had 4 years where there were three times as many killed among the Israelis and the Palestinians as in the previous eight, but they were no less interdependent. They just switched from positive to negative interdependence. The Israelis got out of Gaza. I thought that was a good thing. Under the circumstances and given the inability to negotiate, I thought it was a good thing. I don't even object to the fence in the short run, but I think it ought to be done on their land as much as possible so that we don't prejudge the final property judgment. I think they ought to keep talking. Because, you know, everybody that's fooled with this for any length of time knows in the end what the final deal is going to look like. Give it within a 3% difference, and it's just a question of how many people we're going to die until we get there. That's my view, and I always believe that the more you talk, the fewer people will die. And I think there's an inherent benefit to that. There just is an inherent benefit. If, first of all, morally, it's a good thing if fewer people die instead of more. And secondly, you know, every single death of someone who didn't have to die on both sides is just another scar that you have to claw your way through before you can get sufficient mind and heart to make a deal. So I agree with the president and all these others about not giving money directly to Hamas, given their current position. But there are things they could do. You know what they could say, Hamas could say, we've got a president, and he sets foreign policy, Mr. Abbas does, and he says we're saying no to terror and yes to negotiation. As long as we're in this government, that'll be our position. Instead, they were determined to derail his attempt, his very clever attempt, I think, to have a referendum among the Palestinians. Don't forget, right after Hamas won the election, and don't forget they won by a minority vote because the Fatah group ran double slates in too many parliamentary seats. But right after they won, there was a poll among the Palestinians. Okay, you voted for Hamas. Do you want Sharia law? 4%, yes. Do you want this government to disavow terror? 73%, yes. Do you want this government to make a lasting peace with Israel? 82%, yes. Now, those numbers would probably be somewhat smaller today because of all the death and destruction that's occurred, because of the beach killings and all that kind of stuff. But sooner or later, you know, they can go tit for tat from now to kingdom come, but it's going to be just like it is until they make a deal. So I think they should talk.
So, a question, yes, in the back.
I wanted to.
Yeah, and could you identify yourself, please?
In a second, I will. I'm related to one of those people you praised who's running a good campaign. I'm Zeke Emanuel, Rahm's brother. But I have to say, he and I are constantly fighting over the fact that I'm not 100% sure I agree with you that it's clear what the Democrats stand for. It's not very clear to me what the Democrats stand for on health care, what the Democrats stand for on, say, higher education, what the Democrats stand for on the pension problem in the country. And I think, and this is a liberal Democrat, and I think that we have a very difficult time articulating policies we would enact.
Well, let me say, first of all, I think that the Democrats have made clear their positions on more of these things than is apparent. To be fair to them, and this is one thing I didn't say in my earlier remarks, you can, if you don't have a majority in either house and you don't have the White House, it's hard to get your message out except at election time, which is why it is imperative that the Democrats have a national advertising campaign this time. And they may not be able to run on all those issues you mentioned, but they can make it clear. But I think the differences are clear in both in their basic ideas about the way the country should run, what kind of government we should have, and what kind of politics and policymaking we ought to have. And it's led to drastically different policies. I think Democrats tend to believe that the source of the country's economic strength and national graces is in ordinary middle-class citizens. And therefore, we believe we ought to have a country of equal opportunity and shared responsibility. Republicans believe the source of the country's greatness and economic strength is in the economic and political elite that agree with at least the conservatives that are running things. And therefore, they believe we should concentrate wealth and power to a maximum extent. The Democrats believe in a government that's open and accountable and concentrates on empowering people. The Republicans that run Washington believe in a government that's secret and unaccountable and concentrates on helping their crowd. We believe, we Democrats, it makes us look weak sometimes, that we're not right all the time. And therefore, we believe policy should be made on the basis of evidence and perfected through argument. They believe policy should be made on the basis of ideology and rammed through by attack. And that has given us and it doesn't make them bad people. That's what they believe. You read the Ron Suskind's new book, The 1% Solution, and they talk about how the governing clique speaks with contempt about not just people like me, but their fellow Republicans who live in what they call the reality-based world. And what a bad place that is to live. And that, you know, if you have power and you have the boldness to act, you can change reality, and so you can just ignore the facts. And, you know, 9/11 suspended critical thinking for a while, and they ran that old dog through the chute for a couple of elections. But I think that those things are clear. So we have a different economic policy. We have a different health care policy. I think the Democrats' position on health care is clear. I think that, but I think, to be fair, now that we've got this huge deficit, you have to start by fixing what's fixable, like the Medicare drug program. You can't go out and promise that you're going to say you're going to reinstate through fiscal responsibility and then spend more money than you've got to spend. But I believe there are very clear differences on a whole range of issues that will throw the election to the Democrats unless Mr. Rove is successful in his new campaign, which is, okay, so we messed up Katrina and it's not going so great in Iraq and everything else. You still can't vote for them because the New York Times told you about the money laundering thing and because of gay marriage and flag burning. They're just no good. They'll give your country away. I mean, that's basically his line, isn't it? You can't trust all of us. We're spineless and can't be trusted with the national security. And I noted, however, that it's interesting that the White House is so upset that this sensitive security information was released. But they were not at all upset when Valerie Plame's identity and her cover were released, included, which compromised all the other agents that had the same cover, and God only knows how many contacts they had. That was just fine with them. And nobody seems to point out that there's some disparity there. All we got to do to win is not to go down the road of letting them pull those tactics again and have a positive alternative vision. I agree with you, it won't be so clear, but you have no idea. Let me just give you one other example. The proudest I have been of a speech my wife has given in the United States Senate since she's been a senator. The speech she gave about 8 months ago to a group of venture capitalists on climate change, because it was the most detailed statement that any member of Congress had then given about what we actually ought to do and how it would create jobs, improve our national security, and fight global warming. And, you know, she normally gets a lot of ink. The next day in the press, nothing. I mean, the silence was deafening. Why? It was the same day Mr. Libby was indicted. Now, it may have made some Democrats happy. I personally, you know, think that it's not 0.1% as important to the future of America, what happens to him and whether he was criminally charged. It's what we do about climate change. But it got no coverage. So then she scheduled it again. And she couldn't give it because the Democrats wanted to announce, the Senate Democrats, their own climate change proposals. So then she scheduled it again, quick as she could, for the press club, and she had added about 20% more specifics. And then the story was, oh, this is just a political deal she did because Al Gore's movie was released 4 days ago, and she's trying to get in the mix, even though she gave the speech by then 7 months previous or 6 months previous. So this whole thing, you just shouldn't assume because you hadn't heard any clear statements about our economic or health or energy policies that we don't have pretty compelling policies. And I think the big test for Rahm and Schumer will be getting the candidates for the Senate and House to realize that even though they all need more money for their local races, they have to save enough to run a national campaign to do exactly what you say. Because if we don't say what our differences are and what our program is, then we'll have a hard time having big gains, even though we got good candidates and good issues.
We have a question up here in the front. While the microphone is coming up, I want to ask you a quick question. Karl Rove will be here. What question would you ask him?
I would ask him to give you an honest answer to the I would ask him to give you an honest answer to the following question. If Bill Clinton were president and his Karl Rove, Rahm Emanuel, had participated in conversations with the press to out a CIA agent, destroy her career as an undercover operative, and blow her cover, including all, which undermined the cover of all the other agents, and compromise God only knows how many people they were in touch with who were probably talking about weapons of mass destruction and terror. And then, all because this poor agent had the misfortune to be married to a guy who wouldn't falsify his findings on a trip to Africa about nuclear transfers to Iraq. That is, Joe Wilson committed, and keep in mind, Joe Wilson voted against me in 1992 and gave a contribution to President Bush in 2000. This is a career public servant. This is not some wild-eyed liberal Democrat. Now, if you were managing the Republicans' campaign in the Congress, and Bill Clinton's Rahm Emanuel did this, along with other, at least one other person in the White House, and then President Clinton did nothing about it except to say, tisk, tisk, would you or would you not instruct all Republican senators and House members to take a floor in their minute speaking time and call Rahm Emanuel a traitor and say the president had disgraced his office by refusing to drive out of the White House someone who had blown the cover of a patriotic career intelligence officer? That's what I would ask him. And you know what? I wouldn't be a bit surprised if old Karl Rove wouldn't say, that's exactly what I was done, and I don't know why they didn't. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that's what he says. This guy's good, but you got to understand, their crowd is run, their whole deal, this strip of the Republican Party that controls everybody. I realize Mr. Rumsfeld's from Illinois and others from other places, but basically these people are white Southern Protestant males that run this deal, the people I grew up among and with. So they don't ever do much that surprises me. I've seen this all my life. And when I was a little boy, they were all Democrats. And, you know, President Kennedy and President Johnson made them all Republicans over civil rights. And, of course, now they got other issues. But they're in the saddle, and I just think it'd be an interesting thing to see what his answer would be. Since he likes these treason campaigns, you know. You might ask him what he thought about that ad in 2002 comparing Max Cleland to Saddam Hussein and John Walker Lind. I mean, Max left two legs and an arm in Vietnam. I don't know what else he could have done for us. And he basically just didn't leave half his body to come home and vote for a Homeland Security bill that stripped the job rights from 170,000 civil servants who didn't have any access to confidential information and technology. You might ask him what he thought about that. I'll be interested to see whether any of you do that or not. But, or you might ask him whether he really believes...
Walder is questioning him.
You might ask him whether he really believes that Democrats live in a pre-9/11 world and he lives in a post-9/11 world, and how come it was more important to him to spend more than 20 times what it would cost to put sensitive sensors on all the cargo containers coming into America to protect 300 million people. Well, and they couldn't afford that, and that's his position in the White House. How come he's willing to spend more than 20 times that to give less than 1% of us total freedom from the estate tax, which he calls a death tax, but really a tax on unearned income that's transferred? I might start with those.
I think you've built the crowd for tomorrow's event. Fine. Question up here. Yes. Is the microphone here? Yes.
Thank you. Mr. President, many of us are haunted by what happened in Rwanda, the media, the administration, the international community. And I'm wondering, given the situation in Darfur, if the African Union can't or won't take responsibility for this, there's been a lot of diplomacy, a lot of visits. Is there anything more that you think the United States has a moral obligation to do to stop the killing?
Yes, you know, we were talking about politics before, although I was very serious about all that. It's still politics. This is way beyond politics for me. I think I made a mistake not sending troops to support the UN mission in Rwanda. I've said that many times. I'm even more embarrassed about it because it wasn't a decision we talked about in great detail and decided not to do. We never even had a talk about it.
And it was because it was so soon after the mess in Somalia, and because I was desperately trying to build international support and my European allies to go into Bosnia to stop that. There are lots of reasons, but they're reasons, but they're not excuses. And I feel terrible about it. And it all happened in 100 days. Now, in Darfur, this sucker's drug out a long time. Now, you know where I disagree with the administration. Let me say, I think here, both the rhetoric and the policy position of the Bush administration consistently, starting from the first term when General Powell was Secretary of State, right through, has actually been quite good. That is, we have always said that we would support NATO military intervention in Darfur, and we would do our part to help do the logistics, we've called it genocide. We've, you know, tried to build diplomatic support for it. Here's the fundamental problem. The African Union only has about 7,600 troops there. It's not enough troops, and their mandate's too limited. And I think they've actually done a pretty good job under terrible circumstances. But they can't shut this down. The Sudanese have taken this totally hypocritical and sanctimonious position that we don't want any non-African troops here because they would be outside invaders and all that rigmarole. It's what they know, that the Africans can't send any more troops there. Even if we gave them a lot more money through the UN, I'd be surprised, given the other demands on troops in the rest of Africa, if they could get more than 12,000 or 14,000 there, and there probably ought to be 20 or 25,000 troops there. What I believe should be done, and I think that this is, I think, to be fair to the president now, we've been in a little difficult circumstances because I don't know how many more bodies we could send there given our deployments elsewhere. But they're worried that the Chinese would veto a UN Security Council resolution, I think, because the Chinese want an exclusive contract on Sudanese oil. I'm not sure that's true. But I am sure of one thing, that it may be time to try. And we can show our sensitivity to the Sudanese, since all the people in Darfur are Muslims, by finding other Muslim troops. And NATO could handle the logistics the way the United States did for the Australian and the Thai and the other Southeast Asian troops. You remember when we did East Timor? I just sent 500 troops in there, but we did the logistics to bring everybody else into East Timor. So NATO could do that maybe with a little more, and we could maybe get Bangladeshi troops. Maybe we could get some other troops from South Asia. We can get other troops from other places to do it. But if you want these people to stop dying, you're going to have more troops and a broader mandate and face the fact that we have to risk a veto in the UN to get it. I do think that the president and the Bush administration have had, on policy grounds, a good position here. And I think as a practical matter, they have not had the option to do much more than they've done. But this deal's not working. So I'd like to see it just notched up. I'd like us to turn up the heat. And if one of the Security Council members decides to veto it, we'll let them veto it. And we'll start negotiations and come back and fight again. But if we don't ever take it there, you know, and I wonder what Madeleine Albright's thinking. I'm saying this because I hadn't talked to her or anybody else about it. I just think we ought to do it. I think we ought to. It's not the worst thing in the world to get beat trying to do the right thing, you know. It's not. Every now and then you got to. It doesn't necessarily make us look bad to always. Every time we lose in the UN is not necessarily a loser. Sometimes it's okay to lose. And I just think we ought to throw it out there. We ought to be sensitive to the religious issues and try to get as many Muslim troops as we can in there. But I don't think you can do anything about this till you got more troops and a broader mandate. And I don't think there's any influence, any incentive for the Sudanese to shut down the Janjaweed. And as long as they think the Chinese or somebody else will back them up because they want their oil, we'll just drag on and everybody will wring their hands and act like we care about it. We're not going to do it.
I know there are 100 more questions. I am being told the time for this session has come to its end by a power even higher than President Clinton. Please join me in giving thanks to President Clinton for the time and ideas he shared.